Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. This is episode 143. It's also where you come to hear some of the best true crime content you can get anywhere, right? Now, I'll tell you, usually we have Small Town Police Blotter on. I don't have it on this episode. Still working hard to improve recording and editing. I'm still learning every day. I do plan to bring it back, so hang in there if you like that part of the show. Get some quick housekeeping out of the way here. Head over to Apple or Spotify and hit those 5 stars. I'm not sure how it works or what it does, to be quite honest with you, but I do appreciate your support, and it does seem to help out on the show. Let other people know what you think about it. Send me your comments and feedback. I love hearing what your thoughts are. Let me know how I'm doing, and if you're liking what you're hearing, you're not going to hurt my feelings. I've got some thick skin here. Also, go check out our website at gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where you'll find all of our episodes, our book list, our merch list. There's some more stuff on there. And you know what? We're planning to introduce some new merchandise soon. So head on over there. The better half here, Connie, is going to get involved in that. And you see some new stuff coming out here soon, I hope. Now on Facebook, go to Game of Crimes Fan Club. And that's where you can join our group run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. As we say, she rules with the iron fist, but she wears a velvet glove. There's a lot of posts and comments over there, a lot of things that you'll find funny. It's a good place to go if you need a laugh. We try not to get too serious over there, so check it out and see what you think. If you want even more content, you can go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Now, just a heads up, I've got Patreon on hold for a few weeks while I'm still learning about all this recording and editing stuff, but I do have full intentions of bringing it all back online very soon. And as a surprise, you know, the lady I just mentioned, the chief of domestic operations in the Murph household, Connie, she's agreed to help me with topics and research. You know what? We might even be able to persuade her to come back on for a couple of episodes. You never know. Although, if you heard the episode we did with her our first year, she busted my chops pretty good. So stay tuned for more on that. Okay, now, quick disclaimer, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things. And about bad people doing bad things to good people. I do take these stories very seriously, but see, we also want to have a lot of fun down here. You know what? It never hurts to laugh at yourself. It's a dark topic, right? So this is a show about what's fun. So now, for today's episode, my guest is Mike Chavarria, old friend, retired 31-year veteran of DEA. As you'll hear in this two-part discussion, Mike was what we refer to as a border rat. And you're probably wondering, what the heck is a border rat? Well, you know what? You're going to have to listen to find out. And if you listen real carefully, you might even hear references to a couple of previous guests here on Game of Crimes. You know what? I mean, seriously, believe it or not, the narco world really isn't all that big. It doesn't matter if you're a good guy or a bad guy. It's amazing how you keep running into each other over the years and in different parts of the world. Okay, now, so if you're ready, if you want to find out about today's guest, here you go. You need to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. This is the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all. The Game of Crimes. Hey, everybody. Well, welcome back to Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Today's a special treat for me because today's guest is an old friend, a retired DEA agent. I met him, of all places, I met him in Cancun, Mexico. Tough management conference. I sucked it up, took one for the team that day, but I was assigned to special operations during that time. And our boss said, hey, you need to go down to, I was a brand new assistant special agent in charge. We called an ASAC. And he said, I need you to go down and speak to the Mexico Central American Management Conference because he couldn't go. And I said, sure, where's it at? He's saying Cancun. And I'm like, okay, jackpot. You know, and that was actually, that was one of the few trips that Connie ever took with me. We had a great time down there. But anyway, today's guest is retired DEA Special Agent Mike Chavarria. Mike, glad to have you on here, brother. It's so good to catch up with you again.
It's my pleasure and honor being on the show here, especially after all these years. You know, catching up is the thing we like to do in this agency.
Yeah, baby.
Catching up with good old friends.
And that's why I wanted to bring you on, because you're good for my ego.
Well, it's not hard. I mean, you've earned all that, you know, all that ego. You've earned
it. Yeah, no, it's today's about you, brother. It's all about you. So, and here's why I'm excited, because Mike has done things in his career that I'm pretty sure the public has had no idea things like this were going on. In fact, when I found out some of the things that you were doing, I was shocked. You know, and we're going to get into that in a little bit, but told you how we met. So let's just get into it. We want to take a little walk through your life, talk about your background, you know, where you grew up, what your family dynamics were, your score, you're going through school. I know you went through college and graduated, and sports activities, anything like that, man. So I'll turn it over.
All right. So I was born in 61. Makes me pretty old now.
You're a young whippersnapper.
Born to a Costa Rican-born father and a San Francisco-born mother, whose family background is both traces back to British Canada. Mom and dad had been previously married. They each had their own children from previous marriages. So I've got three half sisters on the Costa Rican side, four half sisters on the on my mom's side. But it was really just me and my brother. My brother was 4 years older, so we grew up together. I don't really have a close relationship with my sisters, but I'm probably between the two. I'm probably closest to the Costa Rican side of the house. So I was raised in San Diego, actually specifically Linda Vista, which is pretty much central San Diego. And I grew up during an era, well, Linda Vista turned into what was called Little Vietnam, when a lot of the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and Laotians settled shortly after Saigon fell. You know, our neighbors were enlisted. It was a lower income community. Enlisted Navy and Marine Corps personnel were pretty much our neighbors. So we used to go to Tijuana a lot, shopping for haircuts and tortillas. And so I got to know what Tijuana was all about. That was my first exposure to Mexico.
I'll bet as you got older, you made other trips down to TJ too, didn't you?
I did. I did indeed.
You know,
not for the kind of shows that we've heard take place down there. All right.
You know what I'm talking about, because I, you know, being partners with Javier Pena, him growing up around Laredo and going across the border there in Nuevo Laredo, he has some funny stories. And you know, as a teenager, you're just curious, right?
Oh yeah, kids are kids.
Yeah. So when you graduated, did you play sports in high school?
I did. I played baseball and football. I wasn't really, to my dad's, you know, disappointment, I wasn't into soccer.
Yeah.
Or as we say in Costa Rica, football. I preferred baseball and football. I wanted to be, you know, All-American. But I did find that true passion in Japanese martial arts. So I started out when I was about 8 with judo, and then did that for 3 years, and it gave me kind of a base to get into karate. And we all started in the YMCA, because that's where it was cheapest, $12 a month, 3 days a week. And then, you know, it was all from Japanese instructors from Japan. So wow. They spoke Japanese. We learned a little bit of Japanese, and we got our asses kicked. as if we were Japanese. But it was fun. I learned a lot, developed some confidence growing up, and stuck with it as an adult. Became an instructor.
Really? I didn't know you became an instructor. Jeez. If I'd known all that, I'd have been a lot nicer to you. You might have kicked my butt.
Well, I think you bought me a beer.
We're easy and cheap, aren't we?
We are.
Hey, I've got a difficult question for you. So when I was young, I took karate. We call it karate, but you call it karate. And why is that? Why do certain people say that?
I'm Hispanic. Well, karate means empty hand.
Okay.
And karate do means the way of empty hand.
There you go.
And the people that practice karate are called karateka.
Wow. That's not kaka.
Yeah. I felt like kaka when I got my ass handed to me.
Oh, man, that's funny. That's, I got to tell you, I took karate as a young man, and then as a uniformed police officer, I had broken my right hand 3 times, in arrest situations where they fight with you. And a bunch of us started taking Taekwondo just so we could learn to fight with our feet, because my hands. And I have severe arthritis because of it. It's, I take medication to try to keep the inflammation and the pain down. But anyway, so you went from high school, and where'd you go to college at?
San Diego State. Well, I started again because of, money. I went to junior college for the first 2 years, and then I transferred to San Diego State and, just got a bachelor's degree. I think my major was in geography.
Really?
So I could. Yeah. I figured I want to get the hell out of college as quickly as possible. And so, the least bit of math and science, I can do it. And I did. I graduated, and then I went in the Navy from college.
Yeah, and so how old were you when you went into the Navy?
Just barely 22.
Okay. I think you're the first person I've ever talked to that said they got a degree in geography. I don't recall ever any of my friends ever doing that, which is okay.
Because most of your friends are smart.
Well, I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
Well, most of your friends are smart. Smarter than Steve.
No, it's good for you, brother. I mean, what gets you through? And then, so you joined the Navy. What year was that? And where did you join that? There, right there in San Diego, I presume.
I thought I was recruited and took the pilot exam and passed it and got a decent score. And then I went to Aviation Officer Candidate School in Pensacola, Florida, shaved my head, was screamed at by the Marines, and, that was a lot of fun. And then I got my commission. I managed to graduate and got my commission as an ensign, and then was sent to flight school.
Now, wait a minute. You passed the pilot's test. I know that's not simple, and that's not the easiest position to attain in any branch of the military. And you're saying you're not a smart guy. Holy cow, man. You just jumped way up there in the academic scale. I don't think that's something I could have done.
Oh, yes, you could have. My buddies in AOCS, there were music majors. There were art majors. I'm sure there were even a couple basket weaving majors.
Wait a minute. This is our military protecting us. Don't tell us these kind of stories.
Well, hey, it's no different than the DEA. We get a couple mixed in.
Oh, yeah. Don't expect anything, brother.
Good Lord.
Now, you encountered a challenge during your pilot training. Is that right?
I did. What happened? Well, when I was going through flight school, I was injured, got tendonitis in both legs, nearly had to recycle, and ended up going to the base doctor, and he said, you have one of two choices to make. You either recycle and go back to the very beginning, which the very beginning is not quite like Seal, you know, buds, but it's pretty nasty. A few weeks where they put a dome helmet on you and call it and call you poopies and run you around pretty hard. I didn't want to do that over again. So he said, your other option is just to run it through and develop scar tissue. The pain will go away, but you're going to feel like shit when you're an old man. And so now I feel like shit as an old man.
That was great advice from a doctor, wasn't it?
Straight talk.
Oh, my goodness. But then did you have some vision issues?
Yes, yes. Well, After getting a commission with as an ensign, I went to flight school. So I started flying the T-34, which is a turboprop trainer, and was flying around going through primary. And on your birthday, you have to take a full flight physical, and they check from head to toe, and they determined that my eyes, the visual acuity had diminished from 20/20 to 20/25 in one eye during that time. You know, because there's no war, they were pretty heavy with pilot candidates. So they said, you can either sit in the back seat or you can go on a ship. So my first child was due, and I said, I'm not going on a ship. That's 8 months out of the year. And then I don't want to sit in the back seat. It's like driving on the back. You know, it's a passenger on a motorcycle going 180.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
That takes all the excitement out of it.
Yeah.
So what happened?
So they gave me an opportunity to get out and retain my reserve commission. And while I was processing out of the Navy, it was in Pensacola. They gave me an assignment to work alongside the Naval Investigative Service. Nowadays, they call it NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service. So I did that, and I kind of liked it. Even though I was an officer not doing much, I got to see these guys, and, you know, they were feds, 1811s, just like we are in DEA. And they said, hey, why don't you apply with us? And I did. One of the guys I really admired ended up going to DEA. So his name is Palomino. And you might know him. Jim Palomino.
Yeah, I know Jim. In fact, Jim was with me when I came to Cancun when I met you.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Wow,
what a small world.
It is, because I brought Connie down and Jim brought his wife. That was the first time we'd met. And the four of us, you know, we got to be friends down there, and the ladies kept each other entertained while we were at the conference with you guys. But wow, I haven't heard Jim's name in quite a while.
How about that? It's a small world, Steve.
Brother, they say, you know, 6 degrees of separation. It's more like 1 or 2 degrees of separation.
Without a doubt.
So now you're getting your appetite whetted just a little bit for criminal investigation. And how long did you stay with NCIS or NIS, but what we now know as NCIS, you decided to come over to be a narcotics agent?
I was processing out of the Navy, put my application in. By the time I arrived to San Diego from Florida, I was hired. It was a heavy recruiting era for NCIS or NIS. So I started out, went to Glencoe, Georgia, and you know, that's where DEA was still training their folks. And so I talked a lot to the DEA guys, and I got a little flavor for, you know, for what they were doing. And so I went back to San Diego, got assigned to Naval Station, which is where we park all of our ships. And I took a real interest in the drug investigations. I had the short hair, blah, blah, blah. I look like a Navy kid. So I started buying dope in San Diego, on the streets of San Diego, working with DEA and the San Diego PD street team. And then I really, really took a big interest in the dope. This was July of 1984 when I started.
So, you know, I'm a little surprised to hear NCIS guys doing dope buys off base. How does that work? Were you a designated task force officer? Or?
No. NCIS has their charter is to conduct investigations of all crimes committed by both Navy and Marine Corps personnel on and off base. Obviously, we have to coordinate our efforts with the local civilian authorities, and in this case, you know, DEA and the PD. But we were able to go and testify in civilian prosecutions, and that's where I actually had my first experiences writing an affidavit for a search warrant on a guy that I was buying dope from. I was buying blotter acid and I think some weed. The guy was always high. So, but it was fun because that was my first opportunity to, you know, deal with the courts, you know, on the civilian side.
Just the segue here just a little bit. When I joined DEA, I'd already been a cop for 12 years, and I was concerned that a single mission agency like DEA, which is the only single mission agency in the entire federal law enforcement community, I thought, you know what, this might get a little bit boring, but once you get into it, it's just so exciting. You know, did you feel like that?
I did. I thought maybe I'll get tired of it, and I'll see if maybe I can, you know, do something else from DEA, but I never did. And not only working in the office do you get an array of different types of cases, but when you go from one office to another, man, you know, well, you know, it the sky's the limit. It's your creativity.
Yeah. You had mentioned, I meant to bring this up just now, but you'd mentioned an 1811. Can you explain to our listeners what an 1811 is in the federal service?
It is what we call a series that empowers us federally to conduct federal investigations, you know, work with federal prosecutors and be gun toters, you know, and have the federal authority to go out and arrest people that we're investigating.
Very good. That's just, you know, I know our listeners are not stupid. They're a whole lot smarter than I am, but we try to explain things here just for those who are not educated in the ways of the feds. So now when you were working as a special agent with NCIS, is it okay to call it NCIS rather than NIS? That's what everybody calls
of course.
It now. Okay, good.
Sure thing.
I think you mentioned that you might have had a first lesson in being ready to take care of business on the street. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It, in fact, has to do with that first search warrant affidavit that I wrote. The guys were excited to let me write the warrant or write the affidavit, get the authority, and then when it was time to execute the search warrant, they gave me the honor of being first through the door. So I was first through the door, and I had my Ruger 357 ready, and sure enough, I confronted that guy who was always high. But in mm-hmm. this case, he was about 3 or 4 feet away from me with a freaking samurai sword over his head. And, you know, I was scared shitless immediately. And my because of training and stuff and my instincts, my trigger finger started. I, you know, put some pressure on the trigger, but mm-hmm. it was a split second. And I hesitated. And in karate, you know, they say hesitation leads to meditation in the prone position. Thankfully, the dude dropped his sword behind his back. But had he brought the sword forward, I might have gotten a round or two off, but my head would have been, you know, split in two. So it was a motivator and a real point that I had to think about as a law enforcement officer. If you're carrying a gun, think about that ahead of time. Don't try to make a decision, that could cost you your life, because you're not there to lose your life. You're there to protect the citizenry and enforce the laws.
My prior host, co-host on here, Morgan, and I, we've had numerous discussions. Our listeners have heard our opinions on this. You know, the first thing that came to mind when you encounter somebody with a sword is this idiot brought a knife to a gunfight. You know, that's not a good thing, right? But being your first time in the door, You do. I mean, after you went and changed your underwear, I'm sure, because you probably just crapped your pants. I would have. You know, you do have to consider, do I have the mental ability, and am I willing to use that? Am I willing to encounter these situations over and over again throughout my career where I could possibly be severely injured or die for people that I don't even know? You know, my personal opinion is I think that the good Lord gives us all special abilities. You know, and obviously, you know, your career went on in excess of 30 years. So he gave you the ability and you're still alive and here with us today. Same with me. And things like that, you do play them over in your mind because you want to learn in the future how you can better protect yourself and your teammates. But, you know, things like that, I had situations just like you did, and you might lose a night's sleep or have a restless night, but I don't know about you, you can tell us your side here, but I always went through it and came out like, yeah, I did what I was supposed to do, and I survived, thank you, God, and help me not to get myself in a situation like that again. So did you have that, like, come to Jesus meeting at nighttime?
I did. And you know what? It made me that much more eager to get better at the, you know, at our chosen profession. And you know what they say, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But Steve, you know, as well as I do in law enforcement, it's like being a fireman. Now the firemen, they're running towards the fire. Most people are running away from the fire. Mm-hmm. And that, as our in our chosen profession, we're running towards the bad guys, not away from them.
Absolutely. And, you know, I know our listeners, we're only recording audio today. You can't see us, but I got the biggest smile on my face because I've been asked over and over again, what kind of idiot are you that you would take a job like you had, you know, and do the things that you did? And you try to explain to them, and if you haven't been in life and death situation, it doesn't have to be law enforcement or first responders. It could be any job. I mean, you can get killed in just about any job out there. But if you haven't been in that life and death situation, especially repeatedly, and survived, you don't understand the adrenaline rush you get out of, the excitement, the eagerness to go, man, that was exciting. What's the next thing we can do? You know, I guess it says something about our lack of mental capabilities. I don't know. I don't know how to explain that any better. But you know how, I mean, I've been retired now for over 10 years. I'm not sure that I would be one of the guys running towards the gunfire anymore. I like to think I would be. I still, you know, I'm an old man. I like to think I'd still respond where I was needed. But, I just want to explain that a little bit because you're just like me, Mike. You're excited about the fact that you almost died.
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to say, well, yes, I will. It was fun.
Yeah, it was. It was.
It was fun. It's fun as hell.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, for our listeners out there if you've been through these situations, do you know exactly what we're talking about? You know, let me know what your thoughts are on some of the comments you send in. But now there's a more serious side. While you were working with NCIS, you had a first experience with one of your coworkers who, for whatever reason, couldn't handle the pressure, right? Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
It was a kid that had just literally graduated from San Diego State. I'm not going to use any names here, mm-hmm. but the kid was a brand new hire, and, you know, he was having a tough time. He was getting ready to go to the academy, but we had sent him to a mini academy. And, you know, at the mini academy, they show the blood and guts of what the coroner does and the autopsies and stuff. And apparently, unbeknownst to us, that stuff made him sick. And NIS or NCIS was his third effort to go get into law enforcement, and found that after, you know, his first effort was with the CHP, I think he went somewhere else. And then his third effort was with NCIS. And each time, once he saw like blood and guts, he decided maybe this isn't for me. Unbeknownst to us and our background mm-hmm. investigation didn't reveal that He came from a family where the mom had committed suicide. He was trying to make his father proud, who was an admiral. And he just felt like a loser. The kid was only 21, 22 years old, engaged to be married. In any event, I had an encounter with him because I was already comfortable with the job, blah, blah. And he just, we were both leaving the office one day. He looks at me. And I could see, you know, the deer in the headlights look, but I didn't pay much attention to it. And he just looked at me and said, "I don't get this. I don't get it. I'm not doing very well. I don't know what I'm doing." And I said, blew it off. "Don't worry, man. Everybody goes through this. You know, it's just paperwork shit. You'll learn it. It's a system and you'll figure it out. See you tomorrow." Mm-hmm. I basically blew him off because I needed to get home for something. Right. And it taught me, well, the next day he didn't show up for work. 9 o'clock, we're so-and-so. 10 o'clock, we're so-and-so. 11 o'clock, we're starting to get worried. We call his home. Oh, yeah, he left at 8 a.m. or 7:30, whenever. But now we're starting to worry. We call the CHP. We call the Border Patrol. We call everybody. His car, put the description out. We look at his desk, and he's got his keys and his creds all lined up. Everything is nice and neat in his desk. And so that ain't good. And I wasn't much experienced, but I could tell there's something wrong with this picture. The Border Patrol found his car near the Mexican border in an area that was remote. And there was a lot of canyon, the area where a lot of the illegals crossed. I met with a San Diego sheriff's deputy or homicide investigator and deputy. They figured they had already assumed the worst. They looked at his car. His car was locked. You know, after a short period of time, we saw a bunch of birds gathering around a bush. I went down inside the canyon with the sheriff's deputy or the homicide investigator. And sure enough, we saw this kid. He was conscientious enough to handcuff his service weapon to a tree to keep an illegal immigrant from taking the gun. He shot himself in the head, in the mouth, and that was just an ugly scene. But immediately I went back to our conversation the day before, and made me sick. Lost a lot of sleep about what I could have, should have, you know, might have been if had I spent more time talking to him. The kid killed himself at such a young age, didn't even start life.
Horrible. It's horrible. Our listeners know that we do these interviews on audio, on video, so we can see each other, and I can see the pain and suffering in your face, Mike. It's one of those things that just never goes away, and we just, you know, our regular listeners, you've heard us say this before. If you need help, there is a national crisis hotline that you can call. It's just 988. If you're having troubles, don't think you have to go it alone. There's nothing more important that we talk about than self-preservation and taking care of yourself here. So that's why you hear me repeatedly talk about it. 988, they're there 24/7, 365. If they're not the counselor to talk to you to help you cope with what you're going through, they will get you a counselor. So please, if you're needing help, call them. You don't have to identify yourself. You can just call and have somebody to talk to for a few minutes, see what you think. But, you know, please don't take the drastic steps there. So just want to move on here. And again, that's 988. Just keep that in mind. And if you see a friend that might need some help, you know, tell them, give it a call. Please do. Okay, so you spend a couple of years with NCIS, and then you decide you want to become a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Woohoo! How'd that go?
Hey, I never looked back. Gus Vasquez was my recruiter in San Diego. I was still with NIS when Enrique Camarena Kiki was abducted and tortured and killed by drug traffickers. And I met his I didn't know his sister until I hired on with DEA, but it enraged me as a law enforcement officer. And with NCIS, I was also a liaison in Tijuana with local and state police for stuff that, because of the Spanish stuff that our enlisted and, you know, guys got involved in down there in Tijuana. And the thought of working in a foreign environment kind of excited me anyway. And so I applied for DEA. And fortunately, I was accepted after about a year and a half experience with NCIS. And that finally got hired at the end of 1985, the year that all occurred with Camarena. I wanted to be part of that drug war.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
What basic agent trainee class were you in? What was your number?
42.
And now, be honest when I ask you this question. Were you watching Miami Vice at the time?
Hell yeah. Come on, everybody was. In fact, to my knowledge, Michael Mann approached DEA at the time, because the show, if you look at what they do on the show, it really pretty much fits what we, you know, did, at least in those days, you know, with DEA, with the cars and doing the foreign stuff and all that was cool. But DEA kind of shut the door on them. And then, you know, he turned us into the villains.
The feds. And the reason I asked that question is because I was watching Miami Vice. I mean, I thought that's the coolest thing, you know, ever. And, When Morgan was still co-hosting on here with me, he would always bust our chops about that, because, you know, we're talking to narcotics agency. It's like, I tell the truth. Did you watch Miami Vice? And I, you know, when Hiram and I do our presentations, we're still doing this, our ninth year. You know, I put that out there, and it's amazing. Cops don't want to raise their hand at law enforcement conferences, but I shame them, man. Put your hand up. Put your damn hand up here. Tell me. It's okay.
Now, great recruitment tool, Steve. Oh, here's a funny story. In the academy, we had one guy who had the theme, the soundtrack for it, and he played it morning, noon, and night whenever we were back in our dorms. And it got to a point where, you know, we wanted to break his cassette player.
Yeah, but man, it's motivational, isn't it?
It was for the first 15 times.
Is that? Did you go through the DEA Academy at Glencoe, or did you go to the FBI Academy?
I think I was the third class in Quantico.
Okay, so and just to remind some of our folks there, when DEA used to train its people at Glencoe. That's where Javier went through the DEA Academy. They wanted to, because it was Department of Justice, they wanted to align it more with not necessarily the FBI, but along with DOJ guidelines and responsibilities and so forth. So until DEA could create its own or build its own academy, the FBI graciously allowed DEA to come in. And for several years, I went through, and you went through in 84 or 85?
I went through 85.
Yeah.
I started in 85, graduated 86.
Yeah. And I went through in mid-87. And I'm not sure how long it was. I forget when they built the DEA Academy, but eventually DEA did build its own academy just about a mile away from the FBI Academy there on the Marine Corps base Quantico. But, you know, everybody we bring on here, you know, I know when I went through the academy, I had to write a memo or two because of stupid things I did or that were perceived to be stupid. Some of the instructors were, you know, they're going to bust your balls no matter what happens, right? So... Do you have any of those experiences?
I didn't have to write any memos, but I saw a lot of funny stuff and some scary stuff. Fortunately, okay, we had really good instructors, to include practical instructors, that were, a couple of them came out of Miami, and it was fun because they came out during the cocaine cowboy era when, you know, shots fired was commonly heard around mm-hmm. the office. And it was just a bloody nightmare during the Griselda Blanco days and the bloody streets of Miami during the Colombian cocaine, you know, trade. But yeah, and we had some funny stories rather than that amused us all, and some scary things that also, you know, in every class, you remember very, very well, Steve, there was always one or two individuals that you thought, oh, I don't want to go where they're going. And one guy, we're not naming any names here.
Right.
One guy had a problem with firearms, and every time he shot, he would, you know, on the range, he would close his eyes. So he wasn't hitting the target very well. But somehow or another, he recycled and managed to get through it all. Now, what's really scary was on the practicals when we were using the blanks and stuff and practicing our raids. Inevitably, whoever he was behind at the time when we were executing these play search warrants would get shot in the back.
Ooh.
Bang, 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 bang.
Please tell me he didn't make it through the academy.
Well, I think after a few times of, you know, gross negligence, he was pulled up, and he had some unique abilities and talents that DEA really, really was interested in at the time. And so they worked with him and finally rehabilitated him to a point where he was deemed safe.
Yeah. Okay.
But I didn't go where he was going. So, but he was ended up being a very talented undercover guy. He just didn't want him, you know, like on the streets, you got guys that do surveillance, you got good undercovers, you got guys can write paper, you know, write wires, and everybody brings a different, you know, specialty to the table.
Man, that's
okay.
I don't even know what to say about that. Just happy I never worked with the guy.
Yeah, I lost track. I lost track of him, but really nice guy. Yeah, I'm sure that was part of it. They sat him down and said, "Look, man, on search warrant. Well, first of all, you're not going to go on any search warrants. You just do the undercover and get the hell out of the way."
Yeah, you will not be on a raid team. Absolutely, mm-hmm. That's very scary. So when you came, did you sign on in San Diego with DEA? That's where they recruited you out of?
Yes, sir.
Okay,
sure.
And then
did.
So you come out of the academy, you go back to San Diego. What's your first post of duty?
Well, Calexico. So I reported to Calexico in August. Between April and August, I was helping out as a rookie in San Diego, and one of the first big cases that I got to help out on in terms of being a surveillance agent was this Bolivian trafficker who was dealing with an undercover agent out of Panama to move coke through San Diego, LA, etc. So the Panama undercover introduced our undercover in San Diego. And so he invited the Bolivian up. He was being wined and dined, and we were following him around from club to club. It felt kind of like Miami Vice, you know. It was cool. Mm-hmm. And our guys were driving around fancy cars, and it was just a lot of fun. But there was something unique about that Bolivian that I want to come back to later on in the mm-hmm. interview that I want to point out how small this world is.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Again, I reported to Calexico in August.
Okay. Now, where is Calexico? I've been there once, but tell our listeners where they are, where that is.
It's located right literally rock throwing distance from Mexicali. Or Mexicali, which is the capital of Baja California, there, east of San Diego, or on the Mexican side of Tijuana, about a 2-hour drive over the mountains. It's in the desert. It gets to 115 degrees or more, 120. You can cook an egg on the sidewalk a couple months in the summer, and it's brutal. There are, you know, canals. It's kind of stinks because it's all agricultural and sugar beet factories, the All-American Canal. But it was fun. It was fun working there because it was in Calexico. It's a small office. Nowadays, it's the Imperial County office because they moved it north of Interstate 8. But then it was, you know, like I said, rock throwing distance to Mexicali. We would, because DEA had no offices on the inside along the border, on the Mexican side, all the border rats, that's what they called us at the time, we would go into Mexico and work with the Mexifeds. So that was fun, especially being a rookie.
I love the title, Border Rats. I mean, I know you guys still get together once a year, I think, and have a big reunion. I'm not going to say you drink alcohol because that would never happen to a DEA. Just because DEA says drunk every afternoon, that doesn't make it true. Right? But the fact that you got, I mean, think about this, everybody. The fact that we got DEA agents going across the border in Mexico, was it, and we're going to get more into depth about Mexico here towards the end of the interview, but at that time, was Mexico as dangerous as it is today?
Of course, I wasn't aware of you know, just how dangerous it was, but I would say, in all honesty, there's not much difference between yesteryear and today. It's just, you know, a bit more sophisticated in how things are done, but it's still a country. Well, now it's probably even more dangerous because literally the government of Mexico has lost control. The the violence down there is at the crisis level. In fact, I would call it you know, a terrorist state. It really,
and let's save that for later in the interview, because I want to finish up on that topic. That's one of the best things about your interviews is getting some insight into that. But just the fact that you're going down it, I mean, I'm sure you weren't scared because, man, you are carrying a DEA badge. You are a stud now. I mean, you're going to swagger down into Mexico. You got the look, probably got the long hair. You still got hair. I don't have any hair. You know, got your bling on down there. Everybody's afraid of you, right?
You're wrong. Hey, they ran the show down there. We were just happy to, you know, be going down there and eating tacos and drinking a couple Coronas every now and then. But no, we did cross a few times a week. A typical case would involve, you know, if we got informant information and it had to do with, let's say, a stash house down south, we would go deliver the or share the information with our Mexfed friends and then be off to the races. So in many instances, we would also respond to the port of entry when the customs or immigration folks discovered a load of weed or coke or meth or whatever, heroin, whatever it was. We would go and make contact with the defendant, take the defendant off their hands, interview them, read them their rights, interrogate them, and then process them through the judicial system. Many cases, they were Mexican nationals with no ties to the United States. We would simply pick up the phone, call the U.S. Attorney's office, and get what was called a declination, where the U.S. attorneys would say, yeah, we're not interested in prosecuting. You know, send them back to Mexico and let them deal with it. So we would pick up the phone, call the comandante, and we'd say, we've got one for you. They would come, pick them up, and we would go back south and work the case and go in whatever direction, you know, they saw fit. In one particular instance, the defendant was a state cop. We didn't know that. But when the Mexfeds showed up, they stepped in the room, the holding cell, and I'll make this sound so your listeners can identify with it. That's about what it sounded when the Mexfed walked up to the state judicial and slapped him in the face. We had to grab him immediately and say, whoa, you are not in Mexico.
Yeah, right.
You are not in Mexico. There was no love affair between the Mexfeds and the state cops. They pretty much, you know, were at it, one another's throats. Of course, one called the other more corrupt than the other, et cetera. And so they would take the defendant down south, and we would run and gun with them. We were armed. Not sure if that was, you know, like, allowed, but we were armed. And we just worked cases with them and shared information. There was a very well-known comandante in charge at the time when I got there. His name was Guillermo Robles Lisiaga. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of heavy-handed. Everybody respected him, but he played well with us. He played very well with us, so well that he got himself removed from the Mexicali Plaza because he went after a ranch that belonged to the Quintero Payan family.
Man, I just the thoughts of that just ticks you off, because that's just a great indicator of how high the corruption goes within that government. You know, here's a successful police officer doing his job, and he's doing it so well that they pull him out. Just tell our listeners, how much jurisdiction did you have as a U.S. federal agent going into Mexico? How much jurisdiction did you have down there?
Zero.
Yeah.
We are, when you cross that international line, we are not law enforcement officers. We are intelligence. We're liaison. So we swap and share intelligence. In some cases, depending on the country, we're invited to take part either officially or unofficially in, you know, operations that can, you know, end up in nasty entanglements with the bad guys. And so, yeah, there were some shootings and some chases, and I was allowed to do undercover work. Again, we were unaware as to what the official policies were about carrying guns, but we all carried, and the Mexifits knew it. In fact, I remember the question being asked, hey, so what happens if we have to shoot a bad guy? And they just looked at us, shake their head, and say, we shot him. You just go home. Yay!
Oh, man.
Yeah, have some tacos on your way out.
Yeah. You know, that's a phenomenal working relationship, one that I don't think would be enjoyed today, to be quite honest with you. But when you say you were working undercover, was that on the U.S. side or the Mexican side or both sides?
Well, both sides, both sides. Both sides had their, you know, the little intricacies and mm-hmm. challenges. On the Mexican side, you know, we weren't wired. We were relying on giving the bus signal, and we're just buying a little weed or meth, not very much coke, but it was mainly weed, heroin, meth. And, I didn't know where the cover teams were. There were a couple of guys in with their group, and they were scattered, and I was just hoping like hell that they were watching what was going on. So I give a bus signal, take my glasses off or whatever, wiggle my nose, and waited mm-hmm. and waited. And meanwhile, the crooks asked, looking at me, waiting for me to pay them for the dope.
It seems like forever, doesn't it?
On both sides.
Oh, it really does. It just brought back some memories of my UC time down in Miami, where you give the bus signal and you're in a parking lot, and it's like, guys, you know, like I might pull a handkerchief out and wipe my face, and hell, I'm wiping the skin off of my head, you know, trying to get their attention, and they come rip roaring in there. But and it was, quite honestly, you know, it was a few seconds, but it seemed like it was hours.
Your listeners can't see it, but we are laughing.
Oh, yes.
It's funny now. It's funny now, but the pucker factor is about a 99, well, 109.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that's why I have no hair up here on the front of my head, because I rubbed it all off with that handkerchief trying to get the bus. Oh, man. So now, while you were in Calexico for, what, about 4 years, right?
4 years.
And while you were there, you got involved with an operation called Snowcat, right?
Correct. It was an era when DEA paired up with the State Department and various elements of the Department of Defense, you know, and DOJ. And we made a combined effort to go down into the source countries, namely Colombia, which was chief, you know, of concern: Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. And I was tasked to go to Bolivia and attack the cocaine problem at the source and try to interdict cocaine before it left country, go after the labs, shut down the clandestine airstrips, and dismantle, you know, whatever, as much as we could.
Now, did they assign that to you, or did you volunteer?
It was all volunteer.
And what was your the training? What did that entail?
They would send us to Quantico, back to Quantico, and we would be trained by the Marines in, you know, land navigation. They'd give us compass, and we learned how to shoot azimuths and use a map, a topographic map, and learn how to pace count, tying knots, determining where we were in the jungle as we navigated from point A to point B, hitting objectives, and that was all part of the part of the training. The other part of the training was tactics, operational tactics in the jungle, learning how to communicate with you know, military equipment, and this like radios, like Prick 77, which is actually a World War II piece of equipment. they taught us how to, you know, survival. They even taught us how to give ourselves IVs, and that came in handy after, you know, because, you know, when we're not working, what are we doing? I mean, you know, you can't live on water alone. You got to have other beverages. So when we would imbibe and get a little bit too, you know, aggressive with it. Yes. Those IVs came in handy.
That's nice to know our government dollars are being put to good use. I got a hangover. Hook me up here, brother.
I'm confident the taxpayers got a good bank for their buck.
I'm sure they did. And I mean that seriously. I know, you know, and that's the thing about DEA, you know, other agencies I don't know about, but I know in DEA, the taxpayers are definitely get their money's worth. It's, if you broke it down to how much we were making an hour versus how many hours we were working, it was a great return on investment for the taxpayers in the United States. It's, and I'm not tooting my own horn here. That's just DEA. That's the culture. You know, if you're making cases, not everybody's a casemaker, you know. I mean, a lot of guys are fantastic on support, surveillance, research, wiretaps, whatever it might be. So, but it's a team effort. And I've never worked with a more dedicated group of individuals than I did within DEA. So it's a little shout out to our parent agency there. During your training, you had somewhat of a little bit of a fear or something, didn't you, that you were able to eventually overcome? Did that ring a bell with you?
Absolutely. Oh, my God. I grew up as a kid just detesting the sight of snakes. I remember going to the zoo and look, going to the snake section and just backing away from the
yep.
I didn't want to go anywhere near it. And what happens with DEA, you know, I go to Panama. We did some training in Panama with Special Forces out of the 7th Group guys that works Latin America. And in Panama, we spent a month at the Jungle Operations Training Center located at Fort Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 1987, 1988 maybe. So anyway, we're tromping around the jungle, and I run into, you know, something called the Bushmaster.
Oh.
And coral snake. Now, the Bushmaster is a big old snake, gets to be about 8-9 feet long, and it's aggressive. And fortunately, this big old Bushmaster was asleep. And so we just took the long way around and avoided that snake. And then when we stopped eventually, I think it was several hours later after a long walk, we sat down, I relaxed, and over my legs crawls a coral snake.
Oh my gosh.
Oh. All right. So that's my Panama adventure. And then I go to Costa Rica, and Yeah, no, Bolivia first. I'm tromping around the jungles of Bolivia with Don Ferron.
Oh, yeah.
And we're way the heck out in the middle of the Beni, Department of the Beni, which is a remote jungle going towards where all the labs are, for the most part, and the clandestine airstrips. We're going towards the Brazilian border. So Don Ferron and I get off the helicopter, and we literally come within inches of stepping on another coral snake. And he looks over at me and says, "If that would bite you, I don't think we'd make it back."
And well, thank you very much. That gives me a lot of confidence.
Oh, yeah. So thanks, boss. And so we managed to get there and do what we needed to do, get back on the helicopters, and we made it back safely to our base camp. But then Costa Rica, I'm as an agent in Costa Rica, we're running around the jungle. And we're cleaning out a vacant cabin, like a shack. And we're all looking down, trying to sweep the floors, checking for snakes. And we all settle in the kitchen. We start bullshitting with one another. And all of a sudden, I see a guy who's looking at me. His eyes avert to over my head. And I'm thinking, what is he looking at? And so he says, "Slowly come towards me and turn around." So I walk towards him, turn around, and it's what we know as a fertile ants. It's another one of those extremely dangerous, poisonous snakes, and they're aggressive. So they're little attackers. They're little tree vipers. And so what happened was it snuck in from a tree into the shack and was laying on one of the shelves there in the kitchen. And I thought, dang it. I'm getting tired of this.
I got the same fear of snakes that you do. I still do to this day. I've got goosebumps. I'm shivering here sitting in the chair as you're telling these stories. That would have been enough to send me home, because I would have run out of underwear by the time I'd seen that many snakes that close. I'll give you an example. Yesterday, my wife and I went over to the Melbourne, Florida area to visit some friends from Pennsylvania and have lunch with them at a condo. And we were outside there enjoying the sun and just catching up and meeting some other folks. And we saw three black snakes, and I think it might be mating season. I think they were out fooling around having relations, if that's what you call it. But just seeing them makes my skin crawl. And one started coming across the parking lot, and I know they sense your presence, and they're not aggressive like the snakes that you were talking about. So I was probably 10, 12 feet away. I started shuffling my feet, and that was enough to make it turn around. And then my wife is my kids and grandkids always call me Pops. My wife, she's so understanding. She's like, "Oh, look at Pops getting big and brave. He's going to attack that snake." She's always busted my chops about stuff. So it was hilarious. Brother, God bless you for what you put up with down there. But now, apparently, you didn't get enough of Bolivia during your snowcap days because you ended up getting a transfer, didn't you?
I got a transfer down there, yeah. And, it went from being, the paramilitary thing, working with the Border Patrol and the Coast Guard and all the other DOD elements. But, yeah, now I was there assigned to the embassy, and I was there for four years. And our job was to work, just like you did in Colombia, work the biggest and the baddest, the kingpins mm-hmm. of the country, in coordination with our counterparts. And so that's what I did for 4 years. And going back to the Bolivia story, mm-hmm. towards the end of my tour. Yep, yeah, in San Diego. Towards the end of my tour, I think we put together an operation with our Bolivian comrades to go after, four or five kingpins and take them down. And they were in the process of trying to emulate what was going on in Colombia with the surrender program.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys wanted to surrender, but we wanted to grab them before they could surrender.
Of course you did.
Of course we did. And we did just that. So we went out, we grabbed them. And one of the guys we grabbed, I'm sitting there and I'm talking to him. And I'm looking at him kind of funny. And because where have I seen you? And after talking to him for about 15, 20 minutes, it dawns on me, he is the Bolivian that we were following around San Diego. His name is Carmelo Meco Dominguez. And he was sending gobs and gobs of coke all over God's green acre. And so
once again, the degree of separation is extremely small, you know. And that was one thing we found out in the not only you working out on the West Coast and down in South America, but I was stationed in Miami and I was always an East Coast guy. But it was the same thing. You were always running into people that you had met before. At first time, you think, well, is that coincidence? And I don't really believe in coincidence. It's just the fact of the matter. That's the way it is in that culture and that world. You continually run into the same folks over and over again. Following your time in Bolivia, what was your next post after you came out?
I went back to San Diego and was assigned to the border office there in San Ysidro. And again, still at a time when we didn't have offices on the inside of Mexico along the border, working out of the consulates. So they picked some Spanish speakers. Because I had some experience working in Mexico, they assigned me as a liaison together with a few other guys. And so we'd go down there regularly. It was a dangerous period of time because it was in 1994 when I left La Paz. And it was at the peak of the drug war going on between the AFO, Ariano Felix Organization, and Chapo Guzman, El Famoso Chapo. And, of course, that meant all the other Sinaloans as well were at war with these guys. And there were killings after killings after killings in Tijuana. State cops were getting killed. Mexican feds, you know, commissioned out of Mexico City were coming down. A couple of them didn't last but a month, and they were being executed. They tried to go after the famous journalist known as Blanco Ornelas, who was reporting on them. That was really an era of drug trafficker violence that really set the standard for violence in the country until later on when the Gulf head, Kingpin Osiel Cardenas, came along.
Now, so were you still during the border rat thing? You're still going across the border there?
Yes. Yep. Routinely working with the Mex feds, furnishing them with equipment to be used to target the AFO guys. That was the focus. And then there were also some other activities that warranted our presence and involvement. There was a huge MDMA lab that was seized, and I got to go down there. It was fascinating. It was huge. It took on an entire industrial complex, and our lab chemists were like, you know, all over it. And so that was fun. And then, of course, we did, you know, the regular stuff that any office does, proactive cases as much as we could out of San Ysidro. We call it Skid Row. Yeah.
You know, just to clarify a little bit on the when you're talking about the Ariano Felix organization, that's basically a Tijuana cartel, right?
Yes. Sorry. I should have clarified that.
No, that's fine. It's. You and I talk about this. I mean, you know, we've done a lot with Mexico and are familiar with the terms that go along. But then you got the Sinaloa cartel where Chapo was, I guess, rising in the ranks back at that time. He wasn't the head at that time, but still coming on up. During this time, you had your first experience with something called Mordida, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Mordida experience really occurred when I was a kid. My first exposure to Mexican mordida corruption. Mordida means bite. And in Mexico, it simply means that that is how people make their way, taking a bite whenever they can. And in this case, when it comes to law enforcement, they take a little bite of corrupt, you know, money for, you know, looking the other way or helping to facilitate or worse. And so when I was seven, I think I was 7, maybe 8. I'm driving around Tijuana. I think we're down there to get haircuts and grab tortillas or a piñata. And my dad, it's just me and my dad. I'm in the right front passenger seat. My dad gets pulled over by a motor cop. And the cop approaches the window. My dad pulls his wallet out. And out he pulls out just enough to see. It was either a 10 or 20. It was in the 60s, so it must have been a 10. Mm-hmm. Just the tip of his driver's license. So the cop takes the wallet, takes the bill, the 10, and returns his wallet and walks back to his motorcycle and then just takes off. Have a good day. My dad looks at me and smiles, and that's the end of that. And so it wasn't until I became older that I realized, hey, this is corruption.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, dealing professionally in Mexico. So, you know, very conscientious of how things worked in Tijuana, and I reflected back on my time in Mexicali and realized, hey, I feel the same way that I felt when I was a rookie in Mexicali. It was just a different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. I remember when we were in Bogota. Hey, players, this is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go and check us out on X, formerly Twitter, at Game of Crimes, on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast, and on our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. If you're looking for even more, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we post a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it's just plain old fun. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.